Okay, good folks. If you could, now refreshed, re-energized, sugar converted coursing through your veins. We're gonna start again, so if you could find your seats, that would be great. And we have three more speakers, the first of which this afternoon is Sarah Atwood. She's gonna give a talk entitled A Veil of Strange Intermediate Being. Ruskin and environment. I'm particularly excited to hear what Sarah has to say because this whole issue of Ruskin and his connection to the environment, the importance of his championship of not ruining the environment is very, very important in Ruskin's study. So here's Sarah and John Ellis will follow and then Clive Wilmer. Thanks.
Well, I hope that Jim is right and that you're all energized and caffeinated and not sleepy, which tends to happen to me after I eat. So the other thing, I want to actually thank Jim for, he's kind of was the catalyst for me to write this talk. It's something I wanted to write about for a long time, Ruskin and the environment, but I just somehow hadn't got around to it. I've written a lot about Ruskin and education, which is a great interest of mine, but really the two go hand in hand, which, you know, he pointed out and said, you need to write this talk. So thank you to you for getting me going. So this talk on Ruskin and environment might seem a little oddly placed after a morning of discussion about craftsmanship and architecture. But in many ways, my subject is essential to today's focus, for Ruskin's understanding of the natural world and of man's place in it is at the heart of his thinking about the arts. There is nothing that I tell you with more eager desire that you should believe, he told his Oxford students in 1872, nothing with wider ground in my experience for requiring you to believe than this. That you will never love art well, so you love what she mirrors better. And what she mirrored for Ruskin was the world, the virtues of its people, and the beauty of nature. Ruskin believed that good architecture, the physical expression of our dwelling on the earth, can only be produced by a culture that reverences and respects the natural world. Without right feeling for nature, architecture would be correspondingly bad, brutal, poorly designed, and poorly built. Therefore, he urges, when we build, let us think that we build forever. Let it not be for present delight, nor for present use alone. Let it be such work as our descendants will thank us for. And let us think, as we lay stone on stone, that a time is to come when those stones will be held sacred because our hands have touched them. Ruskin's earliest work of art criticism was published when he was just 18, and it was called, to give it its full title, The Poetry of Architecture, or the Architecture of the Nations of Europe, considered in its association with natural scenery and national character. Using the pseudonym Katafusin, which means according to nature, the young author began by declaring that the science of architecture, followed out to its full extent, is one of the noblest of those which have reference only to the creations of human minds. It is not merely a science of the rule and compass. It does not consist only in the observation of just rule or of fair proportion. It is, or ought to be, a science of feeling more than of rule, a ministry to the mind more than to the eye. If we consider how much less the beauty and majesty of a building depend upon its pleasing certain prejudices of the eye than upon its rousing certain trains of meditation in the mind, it will show in a moment how many intricate questions of feeling are involved in the raising of an edifice. It will convince us of the truth of a proposition, which might at first have appeared startling, that no man can be an architect who is not a metaphysician. From the beginning, Ruskin recognized that a truly vital architecture was one that grew from and embodied the connections between people and the land, reflecting the character of both. Years later, in 1858, Ruskin would see even more deeply into these connections, attributing the comfortable look of English country towns to the rich scarlet of the bricks and tiles, a color derived from the iron that mingled not only in the clay, but in the landscape and in human blood. Earth, dwelling place, and body are thus inextricably linked in what Ruskin calls the circles of vitality. Ruskin named this interdependence of all things, and you've heard this phrase earlier in the morning, the law of help. The system of the world is entirely one, he declares in Modern Painters 5. Small things and great are alike part of one mighty whole. And Tim used that quote as well, and it's so central to everything that Ruskin teaches and everything that he believed. For Ruskin, things exist in entanglement, and at the core of these relations is the keenness of sympathy which we feel in the happiness, real or apparent, of all organic beings. And this image that I have up right now is Millet's portrait of Ruskin. Glenfinlas portrait, painted up in Scotland in 1853. I chose to put it up here to have an image of Ruskin, but also because it shows Ruskin in nature, in the environment, which was a place that he loved to be and spent a great deal of time, as I'll discuss further in this talk. Believing thus, Ruskin was particularly sensitive to the damaging disconnection wrought by industrialism and so-called progress. "Whenever I look or travel in England or abroad," he wrote in 1860, "I see that men, wherever they can reach, destroy all beauty." He railed against the changes he had witnessed in the landscape, encroaching railroads, the extension of cheap and ugly suburbs, the manufacturing waste discharged into streams, rivers, and air, the litter and carelessness of tourists and citizens alike. This is a photograph of Colebrook, not a photograph, a painting of Colebrookdale. This is in the late 18th century, so earlier than Ruskin's time, but you can already see the smoke stacks, and it only got worse. He spoke against the construction of railways in the Lake District and the conversion of Thirlmere into a reservoir. He vigorously opposed hunting, animal cruelty, and vivisection. He undertook various projects in land management and horticulture on the grounds of his home in Coniston, and enlisted his Oxford students in a road improvement scheme. This is a photograph taken at Ruskin's home at Brantwood of a reservoir that he had constructed and helped construct up on the grounds. And he'd had a lot of different schemes and plans to do with the gardens, to do with water management on the grounds of his home. He founded the Guild of St. George, which we'll hear more about later today, and of which Clive is the current master, as an agricultural community whose aim was to live self-sufficiently by cultivating the land and following principles of wise production and consumption. Many of Ruskin's judgments might be taken for indictments of our own age, such as this following passage written in 1872. "In a little while," he wrote, "the discoveries of which we are now so proud will be familiar to all. The marvel of the future will not be that we should have discerned them, but that our predecessors were blind to them. We may be envied, but shall not be praised, for having been allowed first to perceive and proclaim what could be concealed no longer. But the misuse we made of our discoveries will be remembered against us in eternal history. Our ingenuity in the vindication or the denial of species will be disregarded in the face of the fact that we destroyed, in civilized Europe, every rare bird and secluded flower. Our chemistry of agriculture will be tainted by the memories of irremediable famine, and our mechanical contrivance will only make the age of the mitrailleur more abhorred than that of the guillotine. We shall be remembered in history as the most cruel, and therefore the most unwise, generation of men that ever yet troubled earth, the most cruel in proportion to their sensibility, the most unwise in proportion to their science. No people understanding pain ever inflicted so much. No people understanding facts ever acted on them so little." And passages like this one strike today's readers as appealingly modern. And because, as Ruskin recognized, we like to listen for the echo of our own thoughts, he's often labeled an early or proto-environmentalist. Yet he would have hated that clunky term, which of course didn't exist in his day, and he would have refused the label. He would also have mourned the need to specially designate those who care about the earth and who recognize and respect their place in it. After all, the term environmentalist implies, what is too often true, the absence of such feeling amongst the majority of people. It announces that a fundamental aspect of life has become an issue or a cause, a specialized area of interest and effort. What's more, although we tend to use it as a blanket term for anyone who claims to be concerned with the fate of the planet, environmentalism, isn't so easily defined, and nor are all environmentalists alike. The modern environmental movement began after World War II, in response to the increasing chemical, technological, and industrial despoliation of the land. This is an image of the Cuyahoga River in Ohio on fire in 1969, one of many fires on that river, actually. And thinking of this, oh, there's a warning. Did that come up before? It's a bad fire. Anyway, this picture, I wish I could have found one. I grew up in a small town in Connecticut called Naugatuck, and there was a big chemical plant there, Uniroyal Rubber, and they made tires and then they made sneakers at some point. My father actually is a chemist and worked for Uniroyal. He's not here, he probably wouldn't appreciate me saying this, but the chemical, especially in its early stages and in the 60s and 70s, spewed a lot of industrial runoff into the river. And before my time, and my sister, who's older than me, says she can remember when the river would turn colors. And I looked this up and read more about it, and the river did turn colors depending on the different colorants that were being used in the rubber factory and the sneakers factory and things like that. It's been cleaned up. So this is something that, you know, in my own small town in Connecticut, you know, it affected us there as well. Which river? It was the Naugatuck River. Yeah. But, you know, it certainly wasn't an isolated thing, and still isn't in many, many places. Oh, we've cleaned up the problem. Okay. Let me find my place again. Okay. Historically, the movement, the environmental movement, the modern movement, has combined social justice issues with those of ecology, preservation, protection, access, and sustainability. Activists, who are themselves a diverse lot, have worked to achieve a variety of goals: to preserve the wilderness, to save the whales, to end toxic dumping, oppose industrial agriculture, encourage children to experience nature. They've employed an array of strategies, both peaceful and violent. They've confronted an increasingly complex array of threats and have not always agreed about potential solutions. Some environmentalists have faith in the ameliorative power of technology and human invention. Many look to science for answers. Others argue that we ought to learn from nature itself and from the wisdom of the past. So what can it even mean, then, given this diversity, to call Ruskin a proto-environmentalist? Such well-intentioned attempts to make Ruskin relevant too often mean, in practice, making him over in our image, bringing similarities into sharp relief while casting important and valuable differences into shadow. And we're preoccupied today with questions of relevance and impact. We demand measurable, demonstrable effect. Yet, as the Ruskin scholar Francis O'Gorman observes, this approach often hides the assumption that a thinker from the past needs to speak to the present in the present's own terms in order to be relevant or even readable. Relevance here means, usually, that the present has set the agenda and is asking its own questions of history. In order to plot Ruskin's relationship to modern environmentalism, we must first understand his ideas in the context of his worldview and of the intellectual and cultural forces that shaped it, drawing out his meaning rather than imposing our own. We must read Ruskin on his terms with an eye not simply for relevance, but for significance. Ruskin's understanding of the natural world and our relationship with it is based on a distinct set of values and expressed in different language. As we shall see, Ruskin was undoubtedly prescient in many ways, but he ultimately sees the natural world differently than do most of us today. Ruskin's primary concern is with the deeper moral and spiritual implications of material existence. There's a great deal that we might learn from him about the natural world, not because his ideas mirror our own, but because they are at a fundamental level so different. As the philosopher Mary Midgley observes, all human beings need some kind of mental map to show them the structure of the world. The features of Ruskin's map record a conceptual landscape of intersection and connection. Yet in the modern world, the splitting of the intellectual scene has made map-making much harder, with the result that our mental maps are marked more and more by boundary lines and barriers, with each territory's margins clearly defined. Ruskin's feeling for the natural world was shaped by various influences. His evangelical upbringing taught him to see the divine in nature, and this is a perception that he retained even after he abandoned the religion of his childhood. His early exposure to romantic art and literature informed his aesthetic response to the natural world. And this is Turner's painting of Norham Castle from 1845. And Turner, as you may know, was an immense influence on Ruskin. Ruskin wrote Modern Painters in order to defend Turner and to make his art more widely appreciated. Ruskin's study and practice of drawing taught him a different way of seeing nature, while his interest in natural science, geology, and mineralogy in particular, resulted in practical knowledge of scientific processes and developments. As a result, his ideas about nature reflect the interwoven temper of his mind, and that phrase, the interwoven temper, is Ruskin's own, refusing to slot neatly into established categories. Mark Frost rightly cites the narrowness of readings that categorize Ruskin as either materialist or anti-materialist, anthropocentric or biocentric, modern or traditional. Ruskin blurs the lines between all these neat divisions, and he has a habit of doing that. If you try and pigeonhole Ruskin, you won't get away with it. It can't be done. There's no Ruskin in a nutshell. As Robert Hewison observes, he could see the Alps as a poet might, or in terms of the geological outlines in Saussure. And here is Ruskin doing just that. It's a painting of Ruskin's of the Alps and a sketch, it's more of a scientific sketch of the Alps. In the same way, Ruskin could concede the facts of Darwin's theory while rejecting the cultural and spiritual implications. He could embrace both the power of myth and the evidence of physical law. employ the language of emblematic tradition and that of contemporary science. For Ruskin, there was nothing odd about describing clouds as spherical hollow molecules in pure vapor in one breath and as the gray of Greek myth in another. There's one of Ruskin's drawings of clouds. It's an engraving, actually, from Modern Painters. In Modern Painters 3, he chides Wordsworth for his inability to understand that to break a rock with a hammer in search of a crystal may sometimes be an act not disgraceful to human nature. At the same time, he writes, it's unjust to speak of the love of beauty as in all respects unscientific, for there is a science of the aspects of things as well as of their nature, and it is as much a fact to be noted in their constitution that they produce such and such effect upon the eye or heart as that they are made up of certain atoms or vibrations of matter. Resisting a growing tendency toward intellectual compartmentalization, Ruskin sought to forge an alliance of science, morality, and culture, in which things were to be understood in relation rather than isolation. He stood for synthesis against separation, intent on the ways in which all things bind and blend themselves together. As his friend Henry Acland wrote in 1893, the whole nature of Ruskin resists the limited study of nature, which takes a part for the whole, which studies the material structure of man, forgetting the higher aspirations and properties for which that structure seems to exist on earth, to bring him into communion with the infinite, and through the infinite, to the love of all things living with man or for him. Most essential to Ruskin's understanding of nature were his powers of close observation. Vision is central to Ruskin's work, and we've already heard this mentioned this morning as well. Sight was for Ruskin an essentially spiritual faculty connected with wisdom and understanding. Reverence, he declared in 1863, is as instinctive as anger, both of them instant on true vision. It is sight and understanding that we have to teach, and these are reverence. Just so, he felt, living things are best seen and understood in their association with the whole of life. A flower, for instance, should be watched as it grows, not torn to pieces and scrutinized under a microscope. Such scrutiny diminishes the vital relationships of life, which make a flower more to us than a bundle of fibers, charcoal, and water. And here are two of Ruskin's own drawings again. There's a fritillary and an ilex. I just chose these because I think they're beautiful. Ruskin believed that rightly caring for the natural world depends on seeing it clearly. We become capable of seeing the natural world, he tells us, in exact proportion to our desire not to kill it, but to watch it in its life. For only in the degree in which you delight in the life of any creature, you can see it, not otherwise. Seeing clearly for Ruskin means seeing things whole, so as to understand their interrelations and connections, a principle echoed by E.M. Forster in his later injunction to see life steadily and to see it whole. This kind of seeing makes abstraction and separation impossible. Yet at the same time, Ruskin knew that seeing clearly did not mean seeing everything. As C.S. Lewis put it nearly half century after Ruskin's death, if you see through everything, then everything is transparent. But a wholly transparent world is an invisible world. To see through all things is the same as not to see. Yet man has nonetheless gone on straining his eyes. Our goal, Stephen Hawking has ominously declared, is nothing less than a complete description of the universe we live in. We can hear in this assertion the echo of Enlightenment ideals, of Descartes' hope that those who have understood all that has been said in this treatise will in future see nothing whose cause they cannot easily understand, nor anything that gives them any reason to marvel. Ruskin believed that the first end of science is wonder. But for us, it seems, as for Descartes, wonder is to cease. Ruskin's affinity for nature was nurtured by a childhood spent in the still largely rural corner of London and by visits to the Tayside home of Scottish relations. But his strongest feelings were aroused by a sort of untamed nature experienced on the family's many trips throughout Britain and abroad. In his autobiography, Praeterita, Ruskin makes it clear that his pure childish love of nature was not simply aesthetic but elemental. And he writes, in myself, it has always been quite exclusively confined to wild, that is to say, wholly natural places, and especially to scenery animated by streams or by the sea. The sense of the freedom, spontaneous, unpolluted power of nature was essential in it. I enjoyed a lawn, a garden, a daisied field, a quiet pond, as other children do, but by the side of Wandle or on the downs of Sandgate or by a Yorkshire stream under a cliff, I was different from other children that ever I have noticed. But the feeling cannot be described by any of us that have it. Wordsworth's haunted me like a passion is no description of it, for it is not like, but is a passion. Today, Ruskin's passion would likely be described as biophilia, the result of biologically evolved preferences. a term that itself indicates the distance between our conception of man's relation to nature and Ruskin's. From an early period, Ruskin engaged with the natural world directly and dynamically. He was an accomplished geologist and no mean naturalist. During travels in Great Britain and Europe, he walked the countryside and up and down the Alps, for which he had a great love. He sketched, collected rocks, and studied the plants and flowers, looking closely at all he saw and drawing them. He botanized, geologized, and studied the weather, making careful records of his observations. He was not merely in the landscape, he was of it. A revelatory experience at Fontainebleau in 1845 illustrates this rootedness. While sketching an aspen tree, Ruskin tells us, languidly but not idly, I began to draw it. And as I drew, the languor passed away. The beautiful lines insisted on being traced without weariness. More and more beautiful they became as each rose out of the rest and took its place in the air. With wonder increasing every instant, I saw that they composed themselves by finer laws than any known of men. At last, the tree was there, and everything that I had thought before about trees, nowhere. Ruskin's vision of the aspen is intimate and immediate. In drawing the tree, he discovers its essential qualities and feels intensely the bond between man and nature. This was indeed an end to all former thoughts with me, he writes, an insight into a new sylvan world. Not sylvan only. The woods, which I had only looked on as wilderness, fulfilled, I then saw, in their beauty, the same laws which guided the clouds, divided the light, and balanced the wave. He hath made everything beautiful in his time, became for me thenceforward the interpretation of the bond between the human mind and all visible things. It is this biblically tinted binding of the whole earth that Ruskin wishes his audience not only to see, but to embrace, not only to understand, but to protect. Ruskin saw the law of help manifested in the natural world, in the vital energy that animates nature, and in the interconnectedness of all life. In 1857, he wrote, of the greater unity of clouds and waves and trees and human souls, each different, each obedient, and each in harmonious service. 3 years later, in Modern Painters 5, he described what he called the earth veil. The earth, in its depths, must remain dead and cold, incapable except of slow, crystalline change. But at its surface, which human beings look upon and deal with, it ministers to them through a veil of strange, intermediate being, which breathes but has no voice, moves but cannot leave its appointed place, passes through life without consciousness, to death without bitterness, wears the beauty of youth without its passion, and declines to the weakness of age without its regret. And in this mystery of intermediate being, entirely subordinate to us, with which we can deal as we choose, most of the pleasures which we need from the external world are gathered, and most of the lessons we need are written, all kinds of precious grace and teaching being united in this link between the earth and man. Ruskin assures us that even minerals are not inert, but in their combination with oxygen, the breath of life, are instead metals with breath put into them, possessing a kind of soul. They are intimately connected to human life. Things are not either wholly alive or wholly dead, he writes in The Ethics of the Dust. They are more or less alive. And the natural history texts that Ruskin wrote in the 1870s are mythopoetical rather than technical. Frustrated by the scientific language of contemporary natural history books and the increasing narrowness of their scope, he set out, as he explains in his botany book, Proserpina, to make the meanings of flowers' names and habits vital and vivid to the understanding of young readers. And his use of these two words is important because they point to the things that Ruskin valued most, vision and life. As Thomas Keith observes, beginning in the early modern period, the old vocabulary of nature had been eroded by scientific advances, so that in place of a natural world redolent with human analogy and symbolic meaning and sensitive to man's behavior, naturalists constructed a detached natural scene to be viewed and studied by the observer from the outside, as if by peering through a window, in the secure knowledge that the objects of contemplation inhabited a separate realm, offering no omens or signs, without human meaning or significance. In both Proserpina and Love's Miney, his book about ornithology, Ruskin looks to the symbolism, history, and relationships of plants and animals, emphasizing their connections, and that's the law of help again, with one another and with humans and human life. This isn't an exercise in simple nostalgia, but an attempt to reconnect people with things, to reclaim the material world from abstraction and specialization, and to reinvest it with meaning. In these and other books, Ruskin opposes what he considered the sterility of modern science, what he called the glacial cold of selfish science, which was concerned primarily with function and mechanics. He felt that modern science was vulgar in its arrogance and materialism. His rejection of Darwinism, for which he sometimes is called reactionary or ignorant, was in fact a response to what he considered the dehumanizing tendencies of modern scientific research, which seemed to ignore what he called the blessed harmonies between the human and the lower nature, reducing life to nothing more than germ cells. Ruskin was not anti-science, and he never disputed the scientific accuracy of Darwin's theory. His quarrel wasn't with science as such, but with a burgeoning faith, what Ruskin calls the new higher theology, in the pronouncements of science as potentially true and complete, what we would today call scientism. As the American writer Wendell Berry has warned in our own day, like materialism, reductionism belongs legitimately to science. As an article of belief, it causes trouble. Ruskin makes a distinction between wise and foolish science. In the storm cloud of the 19th century, he excoriates the self-assurance of scientists such as John Tyndall, a favorite Bête Noire, who had declared his wonder at the extent to which science has mastered the system of nature. From age to age, Tyndall wrote, and from generation to generation, fact has been added to fact and law to law, the true method and order of the universe being thereby more and more revealed. In doing this, science has encountered and overthrown various forms of superstition and deceit, of credulity and imposture, and debasing beliefs. Ruskin remarks acidly that the debasing beliefs meant are simply those of Homer, David, and St. John, as against a modern French gamins. Ruskin warns against the error of supposing that science means systematization or discovery. It is not the arrangement of new systems, he says, nor the discovery of new facts, which constitutes a man of science, but the submission to an eternal system and the proper grasp of facts already known. In the Darwinian focus on mechanism and the struggle for existence, what Ruskin called the gospel of dirt, Ruskin saw an unhealthy emphasis on death. Darwinism, he felt, threatened to strip existence of both beauty and mystery. Science does its duty, Ruskin writes, not in telling us the causes of spots in the sun, but in explaining to us the laws of our own life and the consequences of their violation. The materialist eye of the scientist, focusing only on the physical, failed to see the spiritual meaning, the true essence of life, in his subjects of study, be they flowers, birds, or men. Such investigations, no matter how scientifically accurate, were offensive to Ruskin because they isolated material facts from their moral and spiritual implications. Ruskin asserted the inability of man to ever fully understand the natural world, the mystery of life. For all our scientific knowledge, that mystery would remain inviolable, inscrutable, and so far as we know, eternal. And listen closely here to Ruskin's language. Today, as a culture, we've largely lost the language with which to speak about the natural world in Ruskin's terms. Think about that term I used before, biophilia. You know, Ruskin calls his love for nature a passion. We would call it something with a much more scientific-sounding term. There exist individuals and groups who speak a language similar to Ruskin's, but it's not the common tongue, and it cannot make headway against the corporate scientific language that dominates. The language of environmentalism itself has come more and more to convey a narrowly scientific view of the natural world. We talk abstractly and objectively about ecosystems, sustainability, natural resources, carbon footprints, avoiding words with uncomfortable religious or spiritual associations, reverence, mystery, morality. One journalist dismissively calls this sort of language weird pseudo-deism. As Curtis White points out, we have adopted the language of system, nature as a kind of complicated machine. A rationalist rhetoric shaped by the logic of science and reason that looks to science and reason for answers. Ruskin often draws analogies between the natural world and human society. In The Ethics of the Dust, the formation of crystals becomes symbolic of both social cooperation and struggle. In Modern Painters 5, careful descriptions of leaf form, structure, and patterns of growth generate human correspondences, as Ruskin blends classical and medieval emblematic tradition with careful field observation. Every single leaf cluster, he writes in the section he calls Of Leaf Beauty, presents the general aspect of a little family, entirely at unity amongst themselves, but obliged to get their living by various shifts, concessions, and infringements of the family rules in order not to invade the privileges of other people in their neighborhood. And this is an engraving from Modern Painters as well. It's called The Dryad's Crown. Ruskin's editors observed that the human interest was never long absent from his thoughts when contemplating scenes of natural beauty or grandeur. The notion of man's preeminence is, of course, a long-standing element of the Judeo-Christian tradition. Thomas observes that the belief that the world had been created for man's sake and that he was meant to subordinate it and other species to his will could be justified by reference to both classical philosophers and to the Bible. Francis Bacon thought that man, if we look to final causes, may be regarded as the center of the world, insomuch that if man were taken away from the world, the rest would seem to be all astray, without aim or purpose. Similarly, Ruskin declared the centrality of man to nature. Therefore, it is that all the power of nature depends on subjection to the human soul. Man is the sun of the world more than the real sun. The fire of his wonderful heart is the only light and heat worth gauge or measure. Where he is are the tropics, where he is not, the ice world. Yet in his understanding of nature as a web of relations, Ruskin was closer to the ancient assumption that man and nature were locked into one interacting world. He rejects the language of conquest and domination spoken by Bacon and his contemporaries and Beloved Ever After. Whereas Bacon adjured readers to conquer and subdue nature, to shake her to her foundations, to bind her to your service and make her your slave. These are just a few examples. This kind of language runs throughout. Ruskin emphasizes man's responsibility to the rest of creation. Man is to know himself as the son of creation, not as the creation, as the light of the world, not as being the world. Let him stand in his due relation to other creatures and to inanimate things, know them all and love them as made for him and he for them, and he becomes the greatest and holiest of them. But let him cast off this relation, despise and forget the less creation round him, and instead of being the light of the world, he is a sun in space, a fiery ball spotted with storm. All the diseases of mind leading to fatalist ruin consist primarily in this isolation. They are the concentration of man upon himself. Whether his heavenly interests or his worldly interests matters not. It is the being his own interests which makes the regard of them so mortal. Every form of asceticism on one side, of sensualism on the other, is an isolation of his soul or of his body, the fixing his thoughts upon them alone, while every healthy state of nations and of individual minds consists in the unselfish presence of the human spirit everywhere, energizing over all things, speaking and living through all things. And this is different from the romantic notion of nature as somehow set apart or sacred, and it's not simply a restatement of the Christian idea of God and nature. Ruskin understands that the very idea of sacred nature is meaningless without human perception. A number of modern commentators are keen to point out that the natural world could exist, and maybe in a much better state, without us. And some go so far as to call man an invasive species. And I wonder what Ruskin would say to that. But the mystery and the emotional power of nature exist only in our connection with it. It is we who invest nature with myth, metaphor, and memory. As the poet G.M. Hopkins declares of a glorious late summer scene, these things were here and but the beholder wanting, which two, when once they meet, the heart rears wings bold and bolder, and hurls for him, half hurls earth for him off under his feet. Speaking of flowers in The Queen of the Air, Ruskin observes, in all cases, the presence of life is asserted by characters in which the human sight takes pleasure, and which seem prepared with distinct reference to us, or rather, bear, in being delightful, evidence of having been produced by the power of the same spirit as our own. And we are led to feel this still more strongly, because all the distinctions of species, both in plants and animals, appear to have similar connection with human character. Whatever the origin of species may be, or however those species once formed may be influenced by external accident, the groups into which birth or accident reduce them have distinct relation to the spirit of man. In his study of landscape and memory, Simon Schama notes that it is the human mind that makes the difference between raw matter and landscape. Knowing this, Ruskin set himself to trace changing attitudes to the natural world in Modern Painters III. In chapters devoted to the classical, medieval, and modern feeling for landscape, Ruskin explores the social and cultural forces that have gradually altered man's response to nature. According to his analysis, the reverence of the Greek, who never removed his god from nature at all, was diminished in the medieval period, when the nobility began to disdain agricultural labor and to instead consider nature primarily a source of pleasure and frivolous enjoyment. Yet medieval man at least rightly felt the beauty of nature. During the Renaissance, and we've already mentioned Ruskin's feelings for the Renaissance, an avid pursuit of beauty led instead to self-absorption and pride, preparing the way for the rejection of beauty and mystery in what Ruskin calls the fatal 17th century. The idea of definite spiritual presence in material nature having been lost, Ruskin writes, the mind was laid open to all those currents of fallacious but pensive and pathetic sympathy that characterized the 19th century. With us, Ruskin concludes, the idea of the divinity is apt to get separated from the life of nature, and imagining our God upon a cloudy throne far above the earth and not in the flowers or waters, we approach those visible things with a theory that they are dead, governed by physical laws, and so forth. But coming to them, we find the theory fail. They are not dead, that, say what we choose about them, the instinctive sense of their being alive is too strong for us. And then puzzled and yet happy, pleased and yet ashamed of being so, accepting sympathy from nature, which we do not believe it gives, and giving sympathy to nature, which we do not believe it receives, mixing besides all manner of purposeful play and conceit with these involuntary fellowships, we fall necessarily into the curious web of hesitating sentiment, pathetic fallacy, and wandering fancy, which form a great part of our modern view of nature. This sentimental attitude that Ruskin describes too often resulted in a false sense of nature's benevolence, a sweetness and light version of the natural world. And for all his love of nature, Ruskin knew that it was not always beneficent. Mountain glory was ever balanced by mountain gloom, and fair and foul mingled in nature as in human life, because they were not separate, but interdependent, halves of the same whole. Most people who contemplate nature at all, Ruskin writes in Modern Painters 4, look only for what is lovely and kind. But this I know, he declares, and this may by all men be known, that no good or lovely thing exists in this world without its correspondent darkness, and that the universe presents itself continually to mankind under the stern aspect of warning or of choice, the good and the evil set on the right hand and the left. The American high priest of nature, John Muir, reading Modern Painters in the 1870s, objected to Ruskin's account of darkness in nature. How cordially I disbelieve him tonight, he wrote to a friend, and were he to dwell a while amongst the powers of these mountains, he would forget all dictionary differences betwixt the clean and the unclean, and he would lose all memory and meaning of the diabolical, sin-begotten term, foulness. Of course, Ruskin's insights had come from dwelling amongst mountains and of other places besides. But Muir saw only the ineffable beauty and harmony of nature. For him, even the most destructive of storms were productive of a glorious perfection, and that's Muir's words there, that renewed one's faith in nature's essential goodness and wisdom. Like Ruskin, Muir was a keen observer of the natural world. He shared Ruskin's sense of spiritual power and vital energy in nature, his belief in the bond between man and nature, and his distress at the forces threatening to sever it. One expects that Ruskin, who had protested the expansion of the railway and his beloved Lake District, and the conversion of Thirlmere into a reservoir, would have approved Muir's conservation efforts. And there are especially parallels between Ruskin's efforts against the Thirlmere plan and Muir's efforts on behalf of Hetch Hetchy, which was both of which were lost battles. But Muir was a great admirer of both Emerson and Thoreau, and he found their transcendental philosophy ultimately more appealing. And Ruskin, initially admiring but ultimately critical of Emerson, does not mention either Thoreau or Muir. Some of them. There's likely a cultural influence at work here. Ruskin's ideas, like those of his hero J.M. W. Turner, were connected by all manner of strange intellectual cords and nerves with the pathos and history of this old English country of ours, he wrote, and on the other side with the history of the European mind from earliest mythology down to modern rationalism and irrationalism. The optimism of figures such as Emerson, Thoreau, and Muir was encouraged by America's newness. Ruskin's perception of darkness in nature developed gradually from a sense of the death of an entire way of life and vision of the world. Today, having become even more disconnected from nature, we tend toward a polarized view of the natural world as either a threatening, destructive force or a benign escape, a balm for modern angst. Today, Ruskin's syncretic vision of nature seems harder than ever for us to achieve. And for Ruskin, nature is never separate or other. Although the perception of a fundamental connection between man and nature faded rapidly during his lifetime. The ground for this shift, and for the mechanistic view of the world that drove it, was cleared by the scientific revolution of the 17th century, prepared in the 18th century with the rise of industry and science, and sown during the 19th century with the frantic growth of both. As Mary Midgley has observed, even at the end of the 19th century, scientists still meant by science something much wider than a memory bank. They included in it a whole myth, a philosophical conception of the world and the forces within it, directly related to the meaning of human life. Unlike their forebears, however, they were beginning to see it also as an entity on its own, something cut off from and perhaps hostile to other ways of thinking. This process was intensified by the dominance of laissez-faire economics. As Ruskin recognized in Unto This Last, his 1860 repudiation of contemporary political economy, when all relations are those of exchange, we forget how to properly value what matters, including nature. Ruskin knew that the connection between man and nature couldn't really be severed, but it could be ignored, with disastrous results. Of course, nature has always been a resource for man, who from the first has lived with it and shaped it to his needs to varying degrees. But in the increasingly abstract utilitarian 19th century view, it came to be seen primarily as a repository of resources and a canvas on which to inscribe the relentless march of progress. Growing urbanization meant that more and more people inhabited a denatured environment, cut off from the rhythms of the natural world, a circumstance which encouraged the notion, which persists today, of nature as a sanctuary or an escape, something apart from man's daily experience. And this is also what is what drove the conservation movement, particularly in the United States. Even in the wider American expanses, Thoreau complained of man being early weaned from nature's breast to society, to that culture which is exclusively an interaction of man on man. At the same time, technological and scientific advances accompanied a philosophical shift that objectified nature, emptying it of mystery and spirit and recasting it as raw material. And it's this ongoing process of objectification that has turned nature into the environment in the first place. In 1836, Emerson was characteristically optimistic. The useful arts, he declared, are reproductions or new combinations by the wit of man of nature. He no longer waits for favoring gales, but by means of steam, he realizes the fable of Aeolus's bag and carries the 2 and 30 winds in the boiler of his boat. To diminish friction, he paves the road with iron bars, and mounting a coach with a shipload of men, animals, and merchandise behind him, he darts through the country from town to town like an eagle or a swallow through the air. By the aggregate of these aids, how is the face of the world changed from the era of Noah to that of Napoleon? The private poor man hath cities, ships, canals, bridges built for him. He goes to the post office, and the human race run on his errands. To the bookshop, and the human race read and write of what happens. To the courthouse, and nations repair his wrongs. He sets his house upon the road, and the human race go forth every morning and shovel out the snow and cut a path for him. This is Turner's Rain, Steam, and Speed, which I don't put up here as, you know, Turner championing industrialism, but just to kind of reflect Emerson's excitement. Emerson's cheery observation that commodification is the only use of nature which all men apprehend is unintentionally damning. His exultant vision of beneficent progress might still have been possible in early 19th century America, but even then the forces he extolled were beginning to threaten, and Emerson himself warned that nature cannot be cheated. In 1864, the American polymath George Perkins Marsh published his now classic study, Man and Nature. Marsh sought, through a combination of direct observation and thorough research, to indicate the character and approximately the extent of the changes produced by human action in the physical conditions of the globe we inhabit, and to point out the dangers of imprudence and the necessity of caution in all operations which, on a large scale, interfere with the spontaneous arrangements of the organic or the inorganic world. Marsh's purpose was to encourage wise future practice. Ruskin owned a copy of Man and Nature, and although he does not comment upon it, one expects he must have admired Marsh's blend of scientific and cultural knowledge, his commitment to close observation, his emphasis on interconnection and relation, and his rejection of narrow specialization. He would also have agreed with Marsh about the necessity of restoring the disturbed harmonies of nature, thus fulfilling the command of religion and of practical wisdom to use this world as not abusing it. Marsh's pragmatism contrasts with the traditional American glorification of wildness. Whereas Thoreau had insisted that in wildness is the preservation of the world, Marsh, like Ruskin, recognized that as man was inextricably connected with nature, the best hope lay in wise and thoughtful use. In England, progress had advanced like a juggernaut. Blake had decried these dark satanic mills in 1804. And this is another painting of Coalbrookdale a little later on. This is Coalbrookdale by night, 1801. 2 years later, Wordsworth declared there to be little we see in nature that is ours. In his rural rides of the 1820s, Cobbett celebrated agrarian England while deploring the effects of encroaching urbanization. In the 1840s, Engels and Mayhew documented the lamentable consequences of industrialization. In 1865, Ruskin added his own rebuke, one of many that he would deliver, telling the English public that you have despised nature, that is to say, all the deep and sacred sensations of natural scenery. The French revolutionists made stables of the cathedrals of France. You have made racecourses of the cathedrals of the earth. Your one conception of pleasure is to drive in railroad carriages round their aisles and eat off their altars. You have put a railroad bridge over the faults of Schaffhausen. You have tunneled the cliffs of Lucerne by Tell's Chapel. You have destroyed the Clarence shore of the Lake of Geneva. There is not a quiet valley in England that you have not filled with bellowing fire. There is no particle left of English land which you have not trampled coal ashes into, nor any foreign city in which the spread of your presence is not marked among its fair old streets and happy gardens by a consuming white leprosy of new hotels and perfumer shops. The Alps themselves, which your own poets used to love so reverently, you look upon as soaped poles in a bear garden, which you set yourselves to climb and slide down again with shrieks of delight. Whereas man had been used to work with nature, he was now able to work with little regard for it, or even openly against it, armed with ingenious mechanical contrivances and driven by economic self-interest. Nature, having been objectified, was now to be viewed and valued according to use and profit, the earth rail rent by greed and its pleasures and lessons destroyed. Ruskin cites a kind of perverse syllogism expressed by the chemist Baron Liebig. Civilization, says the Baron, is the economy of power, and English power is coal. Civilization, Ruskin counters, is the making of civil persons, a process dependent upon reverence for the natural world and a right understanding of our place in it. The beauty of nature is the blessedest and most necessary of lessons for men, Ruskin declares, and all other efforts in education are futile till you have taught your people to love birds, fields, and flowers, to perceive the mystery of intermediate being. Notice that it is the Baron's formulation, rather than Ruskin's admonition, that sounds familiar to modern ears. In 1873, Ruskin wrote indignantly about the neglect of beloved, once beautiful country towns, indicting the blindness of citizens for whom nature had become little more than a dust heap. His descriptions of rivers and riverbanks defiled by waste at Bolton and Kirkby Lonsdale are a protest against pollution, to be sure, but what distresses him most is something far less tangible. And this is the saddest part of the business to me, Ruskin exclaimed. Pollution of rivers, yes, that is to be considered also. But pollution of young ladies' minds, to the point of never caring to scramble by a riverside, this is the horrible thing, in my own wild way of thinking. Ruskin mourns the loss of a way of perceiving the natural world, a loss of which the river refuse is both sign and result. Pollution and the destruction of nature, for him, were material symptoms of a cultural and spiritual sickness. Attempts at managing the symptoms were ultimately useless, Ruskin believed, if the dis-ease itself went untreated. Ruskin's 1884 lecture, The Storm Cloud of the 19th Century, with its vision of blanched sun, blighted grass, blinded man, is a characteristic example of Ruskin's habit of blending scientific observation and spiritual insight. The plague cloud, as Ruskin calls it, that looks as if it were made of dead men's souls, was not a vision produced by incipient madness, as some critics claimed, but an actual meteorological phenomenon. The weather had altered, the air was stricken. Yet for Ruskin, the darkness was evidence of more than just industrial pollutants. Like the waste at Bolton and Kirkby, the dirty yellow clouds that had gradually obscured the skies signaled a perceptual shift that promoted a new and ominous attitude toward nature. Ruskin would not have liked Allen Ginsberg, and I never thought to couple the two names together. But there's nonetheless a surprising Ruskinian resonance in Ginsberg's declaration of earth pollution identical with mind pollution, consciousness pollution identical with filthy sky. 150 years on, this attitude has become deeply ingrained in our culture and institutions. Unchecked, it has led to environmental disasters on a scale that Ruskin could barely have imagined. Love Canal, Chernobyl, Exxon Valdez, the BP oil spill, to name only a very few. To practices that openly violate the land and its inhabitants in the name of profit, widespread use of pesticide and herbicide, extensive deforestation, mountaintop removal, fracking, and to global consequences that threaten the very existence of life on Earth. We are experiencing, to use Shakespeare's words, a distemperature by which the seasons alter, the spring, the summer, the chiding autumn, angry winter change, their wonted liveries, and the mazed world, by their increase, now knows not which is which. But the cause is nothing so fantastic as fairies. Land Institute founder Wes Jackson has argued that the central dogma of the industrial fundamentalist is to impose the extractive industrial economy on the cyclic and renewing economy of nature. The modern environmental movement is the natural response to such widespread and aggressive destruction of nature by big business and big government. Its aim has been to raise awareness, initiate action, and stop the damage, ideally by means of legislation. There have been many important struggles and successes and many grave losses as well. Yet despite the movement's diverse influence and the many thousands of nature and environmental groups that exist throughout the world, environmental devastation proceeds apace, perhaps because the perceptual shift that so worried Ruskin has now been normalized. As Curtis White argues, the problem for even the best-intentioned environmental activism is that it imagines it can confront a problem external to itself. Confront the bulldozers, confront the chainsaws, confront Monsanto, fight the power. What the environmental movement is not very good at is acknowledging that something in the very fabric of our daily life is deeply anti-nature as well as anti-human. It inhabits not just bad guy CEOs, but nearly every working American, environmentalists included. Ruskin recognized what it is more comfortable to ignore, that the problem is internal and festering, and that summits and protocols and scientific technological fixes can only ever be stopgaps so long as we deny our essential covenant with nature. He would surely have agreed with Thoreau's observation that there are 1,000 hacking at the branches of evil to one who is striking at the root. Writing to the reformer Octavia Hill in 1875, Ruskin explained his refusal to loan her money with which to save Swiss Cottage fields and the meadows below Parliament Hill. It was not, he explained, as you put it, that I want perfection while you are content with the immediate possible, but that while your work is only mitigating of mortal pain, mine is radically curative, and so must our own work be. Ruskin is not without modern heirs. Although not all of them would identify their ideas as Ruskinian, there are a number of thinkers, writers, and activists who share a similar vision of the natural world. Wes Jackson, Wendell Berry, and others bring a strong moral imagination and cultural knowledge to bear in their thoughtful and intelligent discussions of man and nature. They distrust scientism, reductionism, industrial and economic fundamentalism. They share Ruskin's reverence for nature, his awareness of the interdependence of all life, and his recognition that in Berry's Ruskinian phrase, we are alive within mystery by miracle. Like Ruskin, they see things whole, and also like Ruskin, they've had to struggle, are struggling still, against a blindness that has only worsened in the years since Ruskin denounced it. As we've seen, Ruskin's ideas are anchored by his vision of nature as a web of relations, spiritual as well as material, by his reverence for the world in all its richness, and an understanding of our place in the order of things. It is this vision that we will need to reclaim in order to create meaningful change. Ruskin asks us to reevaluate our entire relationship with the environment and with each other. He adjures us to think and to live differently, to stop seeing all interactions with nature, as with other people, as exchanges, to abandon what Wendell Berry has called our foolish insistence on substituting technology for vision, to reject a linear vision of progress, which seeks rapid, immediate, measurable, and material ends, in favor of the old cyclical vision of connection and cultivation. As Ruskin reminds us, God has lent us the earth for our life. It is a great entail. It belongs as much to those who are to come after us as to us, and we have no right, by anything we might do or neglect, to involve them in unnecessary penalties or deprive them of benefits which it was in our power to bequeath. Thank you.